I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword No. 2, Sonata No. 1, Quarantena, for three parts in C minor, Opus S18A. By Benjamin D. Hutchins, hi, with Jeff Depew and Philip J. Moyer. Tuesday, July 28th, 2405, 1421 hours GST. The only sound in Corwin Ravenhair's tiny, self-contained universe was his own breathing, louder and harsher than he was used to hearing it, as it reverberated in the enclosed world of his space helmet. Carefully and deliberately, avoiding undue haste but not dawdling, he pulled himself along a magnetically affixed grappling line that stretched across the void in front of him to the hull of the vast vessel below. It took him perhaps a minute to reach the ship and mag his boot soles to the hull plating, at which point he cast off the grappling line and clicked his push-to-talk twice without speaking. The line disappeared from his field of view as it was retracted from the other end. He turned his head, leaned back, and brought the vessel he'd come from into view. Barely visible against the starfield, the black hull of the one-hit wonder glided silently away, maneuvering with the smallest puffs of its station thrusters, a tricky bit of piloting, and one that Corwin would have had to concentrate fairly hard to accomplish himself. He spared a moment to think of his beloved ship in the hands of another, but only a moment. They were hands he trusted on a spacecraft's controls as much as his own, and besides, he had a job to do, and a strict timetable within which to do it. He disengaged one boot magnet, lowered himself into a kneeling position, and engaged the magnetic clamps in his vacsuit's gloves, then killed the other boot mag and carefully hand-over-handed along the much bigger vessel's surface, following an exposed conduit aft to an opening in the heavily armored hull that was about 10 feet in diameter. Easing himself to the edge of this opening, he double-checked his suit's cron, then looked over the edge. Below lay a conical chamber about 12 feet deep, its wider end forming the opening in the hull plating into which Corwin was looking. The bottom appeared to be a blank, featureless surface that blended with the walls to form a single, smooth contour. Corwin eased himself over the edge and climbed down the sloping, curved wall until he was hovering just above the flat at the bottom, then clicked his PTT twice again and waited. 6 agonizing seconds later, the flat floor of the chamber began to slide until a hole appeared, opening in a lenticular shape and fattening until it revealed itself to be a circular passage of a diameter matching that of the chamber floor, through some intervening mass of metal into an inner darkness, the core element of a gigantic ball valve. If the ship's sublight drive systems had been active, superheated plasma would have been diverted from the central thrust tunnel of one of the main engines out through this lateral chamber, thrusting the ship's stern to starboard, and vaporizing the fragile vac-suited figure who now, without hesitation, wriggled through the valve like a man entering a Jeffrey's tube. It was a tight fit, particularly given the unyielding bulk of his suit's extended backpack unit to contend with, but Corwin made it through. Since the thruster had opened, he knew his confederates were in position, that they had compromised the ship's tertiary maintenance and testing computer, and that they had not yet been detected by security, all of which were good things to know. It also meant that now they were waiting for him, and now that they'd given him access to the interior, he'd better get a move on. He switched on his suit's shoulder lamp and moved down the thruster duct until he reached the inner valve. This stood open as well, and he wriggled through it in turn, emerging into the much vaster space of the vessel's portside main engine thrust tunnel, a circular shaft which reminded him, based on what little he could see in the glow of his lamp, of a subway tunnel. To his right, aft, was the enormous bulk of the outer main drive shutter, which closed off the tunnel when the ship wasn't under power, so that debris, and intruders, couldn't get into the drive spaces. He turned left, facing forward, and the beam of his lamp was not powerful enough for him to make out anything in that direction. He checked his chron again. The lateral thruster self-test sequence his Confederates had planned to trip lasted for precisely 180 seconds, opening and closing the thruster's outer and inner valve at 30-second intervals. It also operated the inner main drive shutter, which he knew, though he couldn't see it, was about 100 yards ahead of him at the same interval, which meant that once the valve he'd just entered through closed, he'd have exactly 30 seconds to get forward of it before he'd be sealed in the main drive tunnel, theoretically forever, or at least until the ship next fired its impulse drives. Neither outcome would be satisfactory. Corwin drifted into the center of the shaft, using economical bursts of his vac suit's station-keeping thrusters to adjust his position until he was as close to equidistant from the walls as he could get. The suit, built for extended sessions of work in zero-G, was specifically designed to hold itself steady relative to outside structures, so this was a fairly simple task that didn't occupy much of his mind. The rest of it was taken up with triple-checking the calculations he'd made when he'd had this crazy idea in the first place. Once in position, he switched off the station-keeping system and just let himself float, reached to the modular accessory control board snapped onto his left vambrace, and pressed a large red key marked ARM. It began to flash, slowly and steadily. Corwin took a couple of deep breaths and steadied his mind. The math was right. The plan was going to work. If the information he'd based the calculations on was accurate. With a beep, his suit radar informed him of movement off to his left, the thruster's inner valve closing. Without hesitation, Corwin pressed another key on his accessory panel. This one lit up yellow, backlighting the black-printed words, Igniter Enable. Across the top of the board, a row of little oblong yellow lights started coming on, one by one, each labeled with a number, counting up from 1 to 10. Against his back, he could feel the thruster module vibrate as its igniter came up to operating temperature. The solution, he would have had to admit, was not ideal. The modular thruster unit he was wearing was intended as an escape system, a one-shot unit designed to provide 10 seconds of thrust and enable a crewman to reach minimum safe distance from a stricken starship before that ship suffered a catastrophic failure. It was all brutality and no elegance at all, a 23rd-century application of 21st-century technology that still clung on in the 25th, because no one had ever come up with anything better for the price or the purpose. Using one was like strapping the X-1 to your back. The system could not be throttled or even shut off outright once it was engaged. Once you enabled the igniter, you had 10 seconds to consider your fate, 10 seconds of uninterruptible thrust, and then however much longer you were going to live, to swear to yourself that you were never going to do that again. Given his druthers, Corwin would much rather have used a proper flight pack, but he didn't have one handy, and in a situation like this you had to make do with what you had on hand. The countdown, actually a count-up, which Corwin thought was a little odd, finished, the yellow lights went out, and below the control switches another, matching row, these red, all lit up at once, and then started going out in order. Corwin had to admit that was a pretty nice touch, but he didn't have long to think about it because this change coincided with the thrusters firing. With a sudden onset of acceleration, he felt his sense of orientation to the drive tunnel abruptly redefine itself. Forward was now down. He had no sense that he was traveling along the starship's longitudinal axis now, but instead felt that he was falling down a bottomless shaft, like that footage he'd once seen of a dilithium mine. Corwin accelerated for 10 seconds, and then, as the last of the red lights went out, the sense of being pushed from behind ceased. He still felt as if he were falling down the shaft, but now he had reached terminal velocity. He jettisoned the spent thruster unit. It tumbled away, sparked against the side of the shaft, and fell behind as he plunged down the center of the tunnel, now adjusting his body like a skydiver so that he would fall head first. 27... 28, 29. He flashed through the inner drive shutter a half second before it snapped shut. Just as he'd calculated. Tons of spare time there. That left him hurtling down the inner thrust tunnel at a velocity he didn't want to keep in mind now that he'd used it in his calculations, heading straight for the complex and impassable inner guts of the propulsion system. The inner shaft was much more complicated than the outer, which was a simple smoothbore pipe that led from the inner shutter to the outer to open space. Here the shaft began to break up into smaller tubes, leading through shock baffles and thermal buffers to the great fusion reactors that powered the vessel. Here, also, the first residual effects of the ship's artificial gravity, which was active in the crew spaces outside this part of the drive, began to be felt, bending his course gently but inevitably toward the lower bulkhead. This, too, Corwin had factored into his calculations. He let it do its work, dropping lower in the shaft as he still streaked along it, then helped it along with a full-power shot from his suit's weak thrusters, as he flashed past a particular landmark he had taken care to memorize while reviewing the ship's schematics earlier. The sudden off-axis acceleration vectored him into one of the smaller channels, this one not much larger than the thruster shaft he'd initially entered the ship through. Only another emergency power thruster burst, using up all that remained of his propellant, stopped him from crashing straight into the opposite wall as the minor vent dog-legged 90 degrees. In his mind, his awareness of the situation was almost like a map on which his position was marked by a glowing point of light. That maneuver had put him into a subsidiary cooling shaft that led not to the reactor but to a maintenance area, in which he would still arrive at present speed far too fast for anyone's good, assuming he didn't drift into one of the walls and smear himself along a couple hundred yards of the tube before he got there. The ship's gravity was taking notable hold. Down really was down now, and he was accelerating again as the shaft plunged toward the lowermost deck. Corwin curled into a ball, twisting his body so that he was falling more or less feet first now, and played the last card in his plan. With a play of light that was silent in the airless shaft, his draconic warstaff, Stick, appeared in his left hand. Raising it above his head, he took it in both hands and then turned it so that it lay athwart the shaft. He felt more than heard the shriek of metal on metal, transmitted through the material of his vac suit, as the gleaming ferrules at the ends of the staff sparked against the inner surface of the duct, grunted as the deceleration wrenched at his shoulders, and hung on. Any ordinary piece of wood, however sturdy, would have been reduced to splinters by the forces at play here, but Stick, once a branch of the World Tree itself, did not even bend. He popped out of an angled opening at the base of the vent shaft and fell about 10 feet into an engineering inspection chamber, hit the deck in a roll with his shoulder hunched to keep his visor from striking the metal plating, and came up on one knee, skidding the last 5 feet or so and halting just short of the wall, bracing himself against it with one end of Stick. The ferrule glowed a dull orange, burning a blackened spot on the gray paint. He remained there for a moment, breathing hard, and then collected himself and rose to his feet, dismissing his weapon back into the ether. Orienting himself, he crossed the inspection chamber to stand by the floor hatch, then clicked his push-to-talk twice again. After a moment's pause, he heard 3 clicks in reply, and then the hatch swung open. 7 hours earlier, 0714 hours GST, Scandia CN-38 system, Kresge Sector, United Federation of Planets. An antique Corellian freighter emerged from the Scandia metaspace jump gate and slipped neatly into the traffic pattern surrounding the Quarian Union's one public facility, a helium-3 fueling station orbiting the system's biggest planet, the gas giant Substance. In the cockpit, the two-person crew busied themselves with the routines of arriving in a controlled system, taking little time to look out the windows until they had completed their initial tasks. Corwin Ravenhair watched his co-pilot going about her business and smiled a small, private smile. As a novice star pilot with fewer than 200 hours under her belt, Utena Tenjo wasn't yet qualified to approach a controlled station like Scandia 1 as pilot in command, which was why she was flying right seat this morning. But she was carrying out her first officer duties with calm, crisp efficiency, making sure the ship was properly secured for metaspace and properly in the pattern, managing comm traffic with Scandia Control, and generally acquitting herself well. She noticed him watching her, gave him a little smile of her own, and then turned back to her panel to hit the last couple of items on the checklist. "Good," Corwin said, looking over the completed sheet and initialing it, as was his responsibility as her instructor. Then, grinning, he handed back the clipboard and said, as he had almost every time they'd done this little ritual so far this summer, "We'll make a spaceman out of you yet." Within 10 minutes, they'd completed docking operations, slotting the one-hit wonder into one of the smaller berths near the top of the hourglass-shaped station. As the Quarian Union's interface with the outside galaxy, Scandia 1 was an open station, which meant out-system visitors weren't required to wear environment suits or maintain a shipboard quarantine. The Quarian crew conducted themselves as if they were off the flotilla. Not that, Corwin knew, they ever really relaxed their strict isolation regime, even at home. It meant, however, that he and Utina could descend the ramp in their shirt sleeves, and without passing through an airlock, into the small docking bay Scandia Control had routed them to. A maintenance and fueling crew of Quarian techs in heavy-duty work suits had already set to work, connecting the HE-3 and exhaust purge hoses to the ship's fuel and life support systems. Corwin had always liked that about coming here, on the infrequent occasions when he did. Quarian technicians had a particular facility for starship work, being natural-born spacers all, and they knew how to treat a vessel right. He waved to the crew chief as he and Utina crossed the bay to the corridor hatch. In the course of her summer so far, Utina had visited a number of facilities like this, but Scandia 1 was by far the cleanest and most quietly efficient one she'd seen so far. Even the corridors and lifts were spotless and gleaming, like the bathrooms at Petro Avalon stations. After a few seconds in a silent, high-speed turbolift, they emerged into a large, sprawling room that reminded her of a cross between a spaceport departure lounge and the central plaza of the Otori Academy campus. It was the first space habitat she could remember seeing, apart from the habitat ring aboard Babylon 5, which existed on a whole other scale, that had trees in it. They looked odd, set against the view of outer space provided by the panoramic windows dominating the curving outer wall. Encounter-suited Quarians and visiting spacers of many descriptions moved here and there in this cavernous space, none of them taking any particular note of the newest arrivals. There was no particular reason why they should. Corwin was at his most nondescript, in work boots and one of the beat-up coveralls that sometimes seemed like all he ever wore aboard the Wonder, and Utina wasn't any dressier in jean shorts, sneakers, and her Coco Martinez jersey. Apart from her hair, there wasn't anything about either of them to capture a stranger's attention. Over by one of the potted palm trees, a slim Quarian female dressed in a typical example of the race's standard environment suit, mostly black Duraflex, wrapped in places with a richly embroidered gray-violet textile, with a few dull silver alloy panels, and a helmet with a deeply smoked visor that hid all but the faintest silhouette of her face, rose from an industrial-looking sofa and approached them, spreading her hands in a gesture of welcome as she came near. "There she is," Corwin declared with audible satisfaction as he stepped into the Quarian's welcoming hug. This close, Utina could see that she was quite petite. Her helmeted head fit neatly under Corwin's chin as they embraced, but she had a hard-to-define air of sturdiness about her. Sizing her up with the practiced eye of an experienced duelist, Utina would have bet that her fine-boned, slender body concealed a considerable fund of wiry strength. "How have you been?" Corwin asked, stepping back to have another look at their greeter. "You look great, as it were." She snorted and replied in a lightly accented, lightly processed voice, "So do you. And you're on time for once." Corwin rolled his eyes. "You show up late to the Museum of Science once, and she never, ever lets you forget it," he said. "Utina, I want you to meet an old friend of mine. Tali Zora Naraya. Tali? Utina Tenjo." "A pleasure," said Tali, extending a hand. "Corwin's told me about you in, if I'm honest, excruciating detail. she added as Utina took the hand. Utina hesitated, not sure whether to be offended, then realized from something in Tali's body language, or the angle of the faintly visible reflections of her eyes, that she was joking. That broke whatever ice there might have been, and she laughed, giving the Quarian's hand a firm shake. "Just how long have you known him?" Utina asked, curious. "Since we were about so high," Tali replied, holding her hand at the approximate height of a 7-year-old. "Though we've only seen each other in person a handful of times since then, it's mostly been email. Shall we?" she added, gesturing back toward the docking ring. "By all means," said Corwin, and they started heading back toward the Wonder. "Where's Chiktika?" Corwin wondered. "Down for repairs. It's nothing major," Tali assured him before he could exclaim. "Just a couple of failed anti-gravity modules, which we knew would happen," she pointed out. "This time I managed to source some of the good ones," she added. "I just haven't had time to install them yet. Maybe this weekend." Corwin nodded. "Well, I'm glad it isn't serious. Too bad we don't have time to do it today. It'd be just like old times," he said with a nostalgic grin. From the context, Utina concluded that they were talking about a technical device of some kind, and not, as she had originally suspected, a pet. Though with these two, she admitted, with a fond thought for her own little Corwin-built robot back on Gerardo, the distinction was probably academic. Delving into one of the many pockets on her encounter suit, Tali removed a couple of laminated cards with lanyards attached and handed them to the two humans. "Here are your passes for the Hecatomus, and Corwin, here's your supporting ID. They'll be checked when we dock." Utina looked at her pass, which bore the same hollow of her face that was on her provisional star pilot license, couldn't read the angular writing that covered the rest of it, and asked, "What does it say?" "Well, because you have a provisional license, that makes you a student, and Corwin..." "I'm apparently on the faculty of the Yuri A. Gagarin Institute for Applied Cosmonautics," Corwin observed with a raised eyebrow, looking at the second document she'd given him. Then he regarded his own lanyarded pass. "These are interscholastic visitors' passes." He grinned. "Tali, you're brilliant." "Yes, I am," Tali replied casually. "Though it's more accurate to say you are the faculty of the Gagarin Institute. Now, you'll be observing 3 classes today. The one in Quarian history is liable to be pretty boring, but I'm hoping you'll enjoy propulsion dynamics and astrogation theory." "Actually, they all sound pretty cool to me." At Tali's curious head tilt, Utina went on, "I'm kind of an exohistory nerd." "Well, you're not going to have a ton of context for today's lesson, but whatever seals your airlock," said Tali skeptically. Utina shrugged. "Can't be worse than memorizing all the Klingon popes." They left Scandia 1 on an inbound vector. Tali took over right seat so she could handle comms with flotilla control. The protocols for an outside vessel entering the fleet itself were much stricter than for approaching the fuel station, and without a native guide, as it were, they'd never have gotten beyond the uttermost perimeter. As it was, it took them 5 comm challenges and a number of security checks before they were given a vector that would actually take them through the vast array of vessels toward the Academy ship Hecatomus, where Tali was a student. After the last one, she turned to her 2 guests and said, "Obviously, the Hecatomus maintains a closed environment, like all our ships. When we dock, a security team will come aboard and perform an inspection. Then we'll all disembark through a decon chamber. You 2 will need to be suited up before we arrive, and maintain isolation the whole time you're aboard." Corwin nodded, made sure the helm was locked on to the Hecatomus' approach beacon, and got up from his seat. "Let's get to it, then." They went aft to the chamber below the Wonder's service lift, where the spacesuit lockers were, and started climbing into their pressure suits. As they did, Tali leaned against the bulkhead by the door and observed the procedure, noting with satisfaction that Corwin had already taught his student the importance of checking each other's seals when prepping for EVA.
"I understand you don't have a lot of space time yet," she said to Utrina as the latter checked Corwin's neck seal and gave him a thumbs up. "Are you going to be okay with staying suited up for the next 12 to 15 hours?
Utrina took her helmet down from its shelf inside her locker, examined the inner padding and the seal ring, then looked up at Tally and grinned. "First time I wore this suit, I slept overnight in it. On the moon." Tally nodded.
"Nice," she said appreciatively.
Then she glanced at Corwin and added impishly,
"Corwin, you dog."
"Ahem," Corwin replied, making certain Utrina's helmet was properly seated. It was. "We must be getting close to the Hikatamos control zone," he went on, ignoring the bait altogether, and led the way back to the cockpit as the two girls made eye contact, more or less, and giggled behind him. It was unusual for two suited humans to join one of the students of the Hikatamos for a day's classes, but apparently not entirely unknown. Tally explained, when she had a moment between her first two classes, that the Quarian Union's educational system was the subject of considerable interest in some outside circles, and visitors from institutions from outside the Union were becoming more common in recent years. Hence the passes she'd acquired for Corwin and Utrina, and the identification card backing up Corwin's faculty status, were not much doubted in and of themselves. The first thing Utrina noticed about the Hikatamos, beside the fact that it was as clean and meticulously maintained as Scandia 1, was that it was probably the most quiet and orderly high school she'd ever seen. Apart from the weirdness of the tournament, Otori Academy hadn't exactly been rowdy, and WPI had been oddly collegiate because of its unusual setting. But this place was more like what she imagined a military academy would be like. Not that it was oppressive or even particularly regimented, but there was a neatness and order to the way the students conducted themselves that was a little unexpected. The second thing she noticed was that Tally's classes, which were a grade level behind what Corwin had been used to last year, and so, relatively speaking, should have seemed like child's play to a high school junior like Utrina, were brutal. Well, no, that wasn't really the word, either. That implied a certain level of instructional callousness that wasn't present. Indeed, the instructors seemed at pains to make sure nobody fell behind or felt overwhelmed, but the subject matter was shockingly advanced by any outside standard Utrina could think of, and if the instructors were helpful, they also weren't shy about looking to the students to do work and lots of it. Otori Academy and WPI had both been top-tier high schools, but at the age of around 12, Tali Zora was already effectively in college. "Is this what school's like for all your people?" she asked during the midday rest period. That would have been lunch if communal dining had been part of the Quarian cultural scene. Tally considered the question and then replied, "Pretty much. The Hikatamos is the best school in the fleet, and the toughest," she added unselfconsciously. "But all of us tend to be educated at a rate that the outside galaxy views as unusually fast. Part of it is because we don't have many long breaks. Obviously, we don't take summers off, for instance. During the days when the fleet roamed space, it was vital for us to finish our schooling as fast as possible, and by the time we settled in Scandia, the tradition was ingrained." She shrugged slightly. "We're a very efficient people. For centuries, we had to be in order to survive, and even today we're not really in a position to kick back and take it easy. Not that I'm saying people who live on planets are lazy," she added, "but, well, there's not quite the same sense of urgency when you know the air is always going to be there, even if nobody's trained to maintain it." Utrina nodded. "I can see that. It must be tough living like this all the time. I mean, I'm handling being suited up right now, but that's at least partly because I know it's only for today."
"You get used to it," Tally told her. "Actually, we look forward to the day when we can suit up and leave the clean rooms. By the time you're my age, it's like getting out of jail."
She tilted her head inquisitively and asked, "What did you think of this morning's classes?" "History was interesting," Utna said. Even without the context, I'm going to have a bunch of reading to do later. She added with a grin, then admitted, that astrogation class was way ahead of where I am right now. It's really given me something to think about. I'd like to get a copy of the text crystal you were using.
I can dupe you one before you leave, Tali said. We don't put our academic or technical works under what you would think of as copyright, she explained. That's another tradition that grew out of the survival culture of the migrant era. But I'm glad you got something out of the class, anyway. It's interesting to see how someone who isn't from a spacefaring nation takes to the business. Some are overwhelmed by the complexities and never really get the handle on it. It would be like asking me to run a farm.
She smiled, the expression barely readable through her visor, and added,
Corwin says he thinks you're going to make it, and now that I've met you, I tend to agree.
Utrina laughed. Nice to know I passed muster. She turned toward Corwin. You're awfully quiet all of a sudden. Corwin glanced at her, then returned his thoughtful gaze to his Quarian friend and said quietly, I'm trying to figure out what's bothering Tali. The two girls sat looking at him in surprise for a moment, saying nothing. At length, Tali asked,
How do you do that? My own father can't read my moods the way you do, and you hardly ever see me.
Corwin shrugged. You've been preoccupied all day, trying to plow it under by concentrating on your hospitality. You just mentioned the pre-settlement survival culture 3 times. Something's up, I just can't put my finger on what. And I wish I could, because I'd like to help.
Utrina looked from one old friend to the other, and remarked to herself that whenever she thought she had Corwin entirely figured out, he always came up with something more for her to learn.
Tali seemed to be having the same thought. She mulled it over for a few moments before saying quietly,
You're right, of course. There is something.
She sighed.
A few minutes before I caught the shuttle over to Scandia 1 to meet you, Father calmed me to say there was some kind of infectious outbreak in progress on the Raya. He had called to tell me he was putting the ship in quarantine lockdown, according to the old procedure, and ordered me not to try to come home.
Corwin blinked. An outbreak? In this day and age?
Tali nodded. That's why I've got the migrant era on my mind. That kind of thing used to happen a lot more often before the settlement. There hasn't been one in my lifetime. I don't think even in Father's lifetime.
How bad is it? Utrina wondered. Did he give you any idea?
No, Tali replied, which means it must be pretty bad. But it would be anyway. Anything that can penetrate our suit's individual biofilters and spread within the greater environment of a ship is automatically going to be a pretty big-league pathogen. That's why the quarantine protocols were written in the first place, so that in the absolute worst-case scenario, we'd only lose one ship.
Geez, there must be something we can do, Utrina persisted.
Tali actually chuckled at that.
I had the feeling you would say something like that if you found out. But there really isn't. My father is an admiral, which makes him the ranking officer aboard the Raya, and he's very old-fashioned. If he's invoked quarantine, he means it. If we even tried to get aboard directly, his gunners would shoot, and they'd be within the law to do it.
He'd have his own daughter shot at?
In a heartbeat. The security of the fleet is paramount. At any rate, there really isn't anything we could do. Unless one of you is a first-rate biochemist and nobody told me.
She stopped, looking up, and Corwin and Utrina turned in their facing couch to see a tall Quarian with the shoulder boards of an officer approaching. Tali got to her feet. Not quite knowing what was going on, the two humans followed suit.
Captain Sarna, said Tali.
Tali Zora, the captain replied. May I speak to you in private, please?
Tali hesitated, looking around. No one else in this relaxation area was within even speculative earshot, so she said respectfully,
These are my friends, Captain. Anything you have to say to me,
They can hear.
Captain Sarna inclined his head. Very well, he said. I'm sorry to have to tell you this so abruptly, but I've only just learned of it myself. The outbreak aboard the Raya is worsening, and the fever has claimed its first casualties. I'm afraid one of them is Zirabel. Tally leaned back slightly, the ghosts of her eyes going wide.
Mother is sick? How seriously?
The captain hesitated, lowering his head, then looked her in the face again and said gently,
I'm very sorry, Talizora. Your mother is listed among the dead.
Tally stared at him in silence for a few seconds, then murmured quietly,
No. No, there must be some mistake.
Ignoring her denial, which he knew to be a product of shock, the captain went on, Naturally, you will not be expected to attend your afterwatch classes. If there's anything I or Counselor Ledvin can do, please... He trailed off, aware that Tally wasn't hearing a word he was saying now. She stood stock still for a moment, her hands quivering slightly. Then she turned and, with a heart-rending noise, threw herself into Corwin's arms, parts of their suits plating, clattering together. He put his arms around her, holding her tight, and made horrified eye contact with Utina over the top of her helmet. Then he turned his face to the captain, who stood gazing at the scene with sadness evident through his visor.
I doubt I can do any good here, the officer said quietly. Best to leave it to you, perhaps, Professor Ravenhair.
He spoke the title without a hint of irony. Corwin nodded within his helmet, not trusting himself to speak, and Captain Sarna returned the nod, then turned and slowly made his way out. The other students in the relaxation area observed the scene from afar, deduced what it must be about, and quietly absented themselves as well. In the back of her mind, as she stepped up and hesitantly put her hand on Tally's shoulder above Corwin's own glove, Utina remarked to herself on their tact. What Tally experienced in the next 90 or so seconds was like the bereavement equivalent of a power nap, a brief but unbelievably intense breakdown in which she clung to Corwin with all her strength and made sounds that might have come from some terribly wounded animal. Utina had never seen anyone so utterly consumed by grief, since she herself had experienced a short psychotic episode in the bathroom of a palatial hotel suite in Worcester the year before. Then, with an almost palpable effort of will, the young Quarian pulled herself together, straightened her back, withdrew from Corwin's arms, and said in a nearly inaudible voice that was icy with forcibly imposed self-control,
Take me to Morden.
It took them 20 minutes to get the one-hit wonder from the Hecatomos's hangar deck to a revetment outside the Science Center on Halo. Utina had been so preoccupied by all that had happened in the last half hour that she didn't really notice the spectacle of their approach to the artificial world. She'd been too busy marveling at the continued arctic calm in Tally's voice as she'd talked them past Halo approach control and claimed them a berth on the surface. She and Corwin were back in street clothes, since Halo was by definition an open environment, as the three of them disembarked from the Wonder and crossed the tarmac to the center. This was an unremarkable-looking building, 3 stories of white concrete with slightly sloped walls and long, narrow, slit windows, almost like a giant bunker. When the trio presented themselves at the security station just inside the outer door, the guard checked them against his terminal, issued them visitor badges, and told them Dr. Solis was waiting for them in the main laboratory.
So who's this Dr. Solis?
Utina asked Corwin quietly as they followed Tally down the hall toward the elevators.
Morden Solis. He's a scientist, Corwin said. Solarian, a biochemist, among other things. Used to be with their special forces. He and Dad go back.
The pass the guard had given Tally opened the elevator and also enabled her to direct it to the third floor. Once there, they followed the red line on the wall to the double doors at the end, which opened automatically to admit them to a large, well-appointed medical laboratory. The only occupant of this room was an elderly Solarian in a black-trimmed white science uniform, outfitted with bionic replacement hands and a couple of interesting facial scars. He looked up at the sound of their entrance, and at the sight of Tally, his face couldn't decide whether to light up with delight or crumple with remorse. "Tally Zora," he said, his voice heavy with regret as the young Quarian approached him. "Assume you have been notified. So sorry." He hung his head. "I failed. Cure not in time." Shaking his head, he added quietly, "No words for what I feel." Tally rounded the laboratory bench Morden stood behind, gently took the silver cylinder he held out of his hand and put it down carefully on the bench, then hugged him. "Shh," she said quietly. "If you couldn't make it happen in time, Morden, nobody in the galaxy could have. We both know that." Morden shook himself. "Thank you, Tally Zora." She stepped back and touched the silver cylinder. "Is this it?" Morden nodded. "Just finished. Fully aerosolized, enclosed in standard injector capsule." He picked it up and regarded the knurled fitting on one end. "Hundreds still alive. Could still save them. If we could get it aboard." Tally took the capsule from him, weighed it in her hand, and then tucked it into a thigh pocket of her encounter suit. "Then that's what we'll do. See if your communications people can raise the Raya. Now that you've developed the cure, Father will have to listen to reason." Morden didn't seem convinced, but he didn't have the heart to argue. Instead, he showed her to the comm console in the corner of the lab and watched as she sought an uplink to the Raya. After a few moments of static and linked negotiation tones, the visor of one of the ship's bridge crew appeared on the screen. "Tally Zora," he said, sounding surprised. "The ship is under quarantine. You know we're not supposed to receive outside transmissions while..." "I don't have time to debate with you, Adev," Tally interrupted him. "I have to speak to Father at once." The comtech hesitated, then nodded and said, "Wait one." A moment later he disappeared and was replaced by another Quarian, this one sporting a slightly different helmet. Utena wondered if that was all they needed to recognize each other, then supposed that if it was what you were used to, it would be no harder than any other method. "Tally Zora, communications access is restricted," said this new figure severely. "You know better." "Father," Tally cut him off, "is it true?" Rael Zora gazed silently out of the screen at his daughter for a moment, then lowered his head and said quietly, "Yes, it's true. Your mother passed an hour ago." Tally stood for a moment without speaking, her head bowed, fists clenched on the console's apron. Then she raised her face to the screen again and said urgently, "Morden has the cure. We can have it to you in 10 minutes. Morden stepped up beside her, leaning so that he would appear on Rael's monitor, and said, "Confirmed. Isolated and identified pathogen from samples you sent during Phase 1. Counteragent ready for distribution. Simulations project 100% effectiveness." Rael absorbed that, then said, "How wide are our error bars?" "Minuscule," Morden replied without hesitation. "Contagion is a variant strain of NCG486H3B. Base pathogen well understood. Once identified, aerosol antiviral G12 readily adapted. Outbreak will be halted within 60 seconds of distribution. Symptom reversal will begin in survivors within 150. Complete containment in 1 hour. Rael turned away from the screen as if consulting another source of information.
Then he turned back and shook his head.
If you had come to that conclusion an hour ago, I would have cleared you to send a team, but we're in Phase 3 now. I'm breaking off all contact with the fleet, in accordance with General Order 14.
He shook his head.
It's too late for the Raya, Doctor, he added with a stiff formality. But thank you for your efforts.
Tally crowded forward, pushing Warden out of her way.
Damn you, Father, don't do this, she demanded of him.
Contain yourself, Tally Zora,
Rael snapped in his sharpest officer's tone.
As an admiral of the Quarian Navy, my duty in this situation is clear.
You know that order is outdated, Tally shot back. It was written in the days of the Migrant Fleet, when there was no hope of help from a facility like this lab.
My duty is clear, Rael repeated. Softening his aspect in Angstrom, he went on, I know you think you can help, Tally. You always think you can do anything. But this situation is beyond your powers to change. The protocol must be followed. No one enters this ship and no one leaves until and unless the infection runs its course. Anyone who attempts to do so will be dealt with harshly. The safety of the fleet must come first.
Why must you be such a pig-headed... Tally began.
Goodbye, Tally Zora, said Rael, becoming stiffly formal again. Keela be with you.
Father!
She tried one last time, but Rael had cut the connection. Tally stood for a moment looking at the blank screen, almost vibrating with anger. Then she said to the dead Link,
Fine, then. If you won't let me save you, Father, I'll do it in spite of you.
Then she turned to Corwin and Utna, but before she could say anything, they had asked her almost in unison,
How can we help?